supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Kimberly Haas, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Dave Heller is off this evening. A week after having the police called on them at a Cinemark theater in West Philadelphia, Ashley and Ishmael Jimenez are calling for a boycott of the theater chain. The couple held a rally outside of the theater this morning with the support of Black Lives Matter Philly and the Caucus of Working Educators. WHYY's Daryl C. Murphy reports.
About 60 people occupied the sidewalk in front of a West Philadelphia theater to support Ashley and Ishmael Jimenez. Last week, 10 police officers confronted the couple following a minor dispute. They're now calling for a boycott until Cinemark reforms some of its policies and training around customer interactions. The family says the initial dispute began after the couple left the theater to seek a refund because of a beeping noise. The manager would not let the couple back in to get their children, who are still in the auditorium. When Ashley, the mother, went to get her children anyway, an on-site officer reported to city police an incident was taking place. 11-year-old Ishmael Jimenez IV was so distressed by the incident he vomited, the parents say. He was afraid for his father.
Usually when cops argue with black people or black people argue with cops about something or anything at all in America, they would usually get shot or go to jail.
According to the Philadelphia Police Department, the number of officers who showed up was the result of failed radio communication. No arrests were made, and an officer defused the situation. Cinemark released a statement denying the family's claim that they were denied access to their children. Ishmael III, a teacher, says the statement is an attempt to paint him and his family as liars.
This respectability politics needs to go.
Yes.
It doesn't matter what we do. It doesn't matter who we are. This happens every single day.
This is the second time Philadelphia is in the headlines over a frivolous police call. The arrest of two black men for sitting in a Starbucks set off a nationwide dialogue about being black in public and private spaces. Ashley says the incident is a reminder of the challenges black men and boys face.
It reminds us being Ishmael and myself, that, our boys have an ugly, cruel world that they're going to have to face. And the best that we can do is prepare them for that.
Ishmael IV says he hopes the theater changes its policies so small incidents don't become big problems. For WHYY, Daryl C. Murphy.
It's an all too common story in the life cycle of an urban neighborhood. Churches built on a grand 19th century scale remain as permanent landmarks, even as the surrounding neighborhoods evolve and change. Old residents move out and are replaced by different communities, and congregations scatter to other locations. The smaller memberships are hard-pressed to keep up with maintenance and utility bills, and developers often covet the land beneath these historic structures. Philadelphia has seen its share of old church buildings neglected and even torn down, but a new collaboration seeks to transform them into community assets. Infill Philadelphia, Sacred Places, Civic Spaces, is a joint project of the Community Design Collaborative and Partners for Sacred Places. It pairs the congregation of a historic church with a design firm and a community organization to repurpose the underutilized buildings in neighborhoods that are in need of civic gathering spaces. Three sites that will serve as models were recently announced. We visited one of them, the Wharton Wesley United Methodist Church in Cobbs Creek. We were joined by Rachel Hildebrandt, Senior Program Manager at Partners for Sacred Places, Heidi Siegel-Levy, Director of Design Services for the Community Design Collaborative, and Reverend David Brown, ordained deacon of the church. He started the conversation by offering a brief history of the congregation.
Wharton Wesley is actually a combined congregation in that it was a congregation that started in West Philadelphia, African-American predominantly, that was outgrowing its space back in the 70s. And Wharton Memorial, which was here at this location, was actually declining in membership. So the solution came to let's see if we can merge and combine history of 175 years as a congregation here in Philadelphia. And over time, the folks who were at Wharton Wesley as the combined congregation, most folks started moving out of the neighborhood and started living other places. So our membership started to dwindle. Oh, we still have this huge space. And so we've been always trying to struggle to find ways to have this type of resource to be a better resource for the community.
Now, the church already offers some programs in the community, your food pantry, a boys' book club, and so forth. What do you aim to do beyond that?
Well, I think that a lot of the ideas that we have in terms of our ministry have come from within as opposed to coming from outside. So we have not necessarily engaged our community, and there's so much need that's in the Southwest Philadelphia community. So we think that being able to have more of a community engagement type of strategy will be able to possibly expand the existing programs we have, but also to identify new ones that we may not have considered just based on the needs that are that exist within the community.
Do you have some ideas what some of those might be, though?
We know that Southwest Philadelphia, there's a lot of young people who are here. There's not a lot of spaces that are as big as the space that we have. So we're really looking forward to it being more of an engagement to have a dialogue. So we really need to find ways to be able to do that.
Heidi, how many applications did you have for this first round?
So we actually put out a request for expressions of interest from congregations as well as from neighborhood organizations, and we received 16 expressions of interest from congregations.
And how did Wharton Wesley rise to the top?
So Wharton Wesley is the most traditional of the three that were selected in terms of its physical characteristics as well as how it's situated in the community, that it is really surrounded by residential, which is traditionally what the churches were. And also it's a congregation that was actually looking to create better relationship with their community.
Prototypical in terms of the trends within the church. So there's a dwindling congregation. It's losing numbers. The majority of the membership don't live in this community anymore. They're attached to the congregation for some reason or another. Usually this is the church they grew up in or their parents got married here. So they're driving in on Sundays and usually only Sundays. They've got a ton of underutilized space, and it's really not easy to visualize what this is going to become.
Rachel, has there been any kind of survey or any estimation of how many churches in Philadelphia might have this potential?
All historic, purpose-built religious buildings were surveyed, and those are the kinds of buildings that tend to have this type of space. And we know anecdotally and also through that survey, through that process, that the vast majority have underutilized space that can be better utilized or shared.
Are you talking about hundreds or dozens of churches?
I'm talking about hundreds.
And what's the time frame for the project?
This past week, the design team has made their site visits to the three sites and met with the site partners, and they now will begin doing work for existing conditions of the buildings, and then in the end of July, they'll actually be meeting with the community task force for the first time to understand what the needs are of the community and what the program might be, and then they will do their design, which will ultimately be revealed in early December.
Well, Reverend Brown, once the design team does its work and you have this plan, what next?
One thing is that we have these skilled professionals who are going to help us to kind of put some realistic parameters around what our visions might be. And what we hope to be able to do is take this plan, and because it's going to be a community engagement process, then take the next step. What should the next step be? What do we want to be based on this plan? And what kind of money do we need to raise? What kind of resources? Can we raise this barn together? I think that's the key.
At the Wharton Wesley United Methodist Church in the Cobbs Creek neighborhood of Philadelphia, I've been speaking with Reverend David Brown, Rachel Hildebrandt from Partners for Sacred Places, and Heidi Siegel-Levy of the Community Design Collaborative about their project, Infill Philadelphia, Sacred Places, Civic Spaces. This note, the project is funded by the William Penn Foundation, which also supports WHYY. Every year, nearly 1,000 hikers take part in the Rachel Carson Challenge. It's a 35-mile hike along a trail named after the famous Pittsburgher, who is credited with starting the modern environmental movement. This year, hikers saw a new addition on the trail, the fracking industry. For State Impact Pennsylvania, the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier reports.
Bob Mulshine is in charge of the Rachel Carson Challenge, an increasingly popular endurance hike through Pittsburgh's northern suburbs. He's a five-time finisher of the challenge, a brutal sun-up to sundown march up and down hilly terrain. Many don't finish. A few days before the one-day hike is set to begin, Mulshine is taking me out to see the route. We hike over a wooded knob, then the woods end.
So that's a nice wide swath.
We look out over a pipeline right-of-way, about 50 feet wide.
So this was
This is the trail right here?
Yes.
Or was?
Or was.
Where once there was a forest, now there's a clear-cut alley leading to a drilling rig a few hundred feet away, which Malshine just now notices.
Oh, and there's the drill site. Now that this is cleared, you can see it. I had not seen that before.
Malshine's surprised, but he's happy with the work he sees.
So the trees have been taken down and removed. There's no big...
The rig is for a Marcellus Shale well pad that Range Resources is developing here on a portion of the trail in Indiana Township. To build the pad, the company rerouted a portion of the trail not far from here. This year, Malshine says, hundreds of hikers will see the drilling operations as they pass by. His main concern is that hikers don't get lost when they cross this pipeline right-of-way.
So all we would have to do is put some kind of markers that would keep people walking right across that. And for us, as a hiking group, this is not an inconvenience.
Malshine says this is the first time there's been fracking along the Rachel Carson, but it's hardly the only industrial activity on the route. The trail skirts busy suburban roads, power lines, even a coal ash pile. He says the Marcellus Shale industry is just another impediment to navigate around.
We don't own any of the trail. We do not control this property at all. We walk totally at the from the generosity of our volunteers who maintain the trails and the landowners and the people who control the land when they give us their permission to use it.
Still, not everyone's happy about the drilling. Kenton Ganster has hiked the Rachel Carson Challenge. Today, he's hiking a section of the trail with his mother, Kathleen, who's done the Rachel Carson Challenge four times and volunteers for the nonprofit that runs it. He says it was a shock to see a drilling rig so close to the trail.
Yeah, it's just not something you really want to see. It's like a strip mine or anything else like that. You just really don't want to see it out here when you're coming to get away from all the industrialism and everything.
Even though he doesn't like having the drilling rig so close to the trail, he thinks it's good for the urbanites who hike it to be able to see where their energy comes from.
Silver lining kind of thing. I do think it's good for the Rachel Carson type of crowd people to see it. Because, I mean, you can look at it and decide what you think, and you can smell it and decide what you think. You know what I mean? And just see, is that something you want in your backyard? Because that's essentially what this is Pittsburgh's backyard.
Range Resources, which is a sponsor of the hike this year, didn't respond to interview requests. But Malshine said he's happy with how the companies handled the situation.
We were thrilled that a drilling company wasn't trying to force us out of the woods.
But what would Rachel Carson, whose book Silent Spring helped launch the environmental movement in the 60s, think of fracking taking place along a trail named after her? Malshine says he doesn't know.
Would she like this? She bought a place up in Maine, a very secluded place up in Maine. We're trying to find the best we can for the people that are living in the area.
And doing that, he says, involves compromise and cutting a trail around the obstacles. Reed Frazier, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
Welcome back to Newsworks Tonight. I'm Kimberly Haas. Justice Anthony Kennedy's retirement sharpens the focus on the composition and disposition of the U.S. Supreme Court. WHYY's Dave Heller sat down with Frank Newport, editor-in-chief of the Gallup poll, to gauge public opinion on the nation's highest court.
Frank, presumably Gallup has not polled since Wednesday's announcement. What is known about attitudes around the U.S. Supreme Court?
Well, we have just finished, prior to the announcement, our annual update on Americans' confidence in institutions, and the Supreme Court is in that list, so we can bring you up to date on that. This is interviewing June 1 through 13. 37% of Americans have a great deal or quite a lot of confidence in the U.S. Supreme Court. That actually ties it with the presidency, which is also 37%. And of the three branches of government, both of those are way ahead of Congress, which is down at only 11%. But I should say that on the Supreme Court, very few people have little confidence either. Most people say they have some confidence in the Supreme Court. Not so for the presidency as an institution. As I said, 37% have a lot of confidence, but 40% have very little, and 4% have none. So there's a big difference there. So all in all, confidence in the Supreme Court is roughly where it's been over the last several years and kind of in the middle of the pack of all the institutions that we track.
If 37% is middle of the pack, are any institutions held in a positive regard?
Well, the confidence in institutions overall has been going down. It stabilized in recent years, but this is an important point that a lot of commentators note, that we as Americans used to be more confident in a lot of things than we are now. A lot of these have gone down over the decades. But in answer to your question directly, there are three of the institutions that we test that a majority of Americans say they have a great deal or quite a lot of confidence in. At the very top of the list, as has been the case now for years, is the military. 74% of Americans have a great deal or quite a lot of confidence in the military. And again, contrast that with 37% for the Supreme Court. Also, small business. Notice the adjective small. Small business, 67%. Confident in small business, and then 54% in the police. And those are the only three institutions that are above that 50% line, Dave.
What if you sub out small and put in big business?
Well, it drops precipitously. That's down to 25%. Although I should note, confidence in big business for those CEOs who might be listening, Dave, is up a few points from where it has been, but still much, much lower than small business.
I might surmise that regard for the media has been slipping over the past years.
That's right. Our data on the media consistently show that Americans have lost confidence in it, no matter how we ask about it. There are only two aspects of the media that we talk about in this poll, and that is television news and newspapers. We don't test radio. We don't test internet news or anything like that on a routine basis. This one just has television news and newspapers, and both of those are miserable. Only 20% of Americans have a great deal or quite a lot of confidence in television news and 23% in newspapers. So neither of those are anywhere near even average in terms of confidence levels.
Frank, we are a mere 5 days out from Independence Day. Are Americans proud to be Americans?
They are, Dave, but that is down. And I think this reflects, when we analyze the data, the increasing polarization that we talk about so much. Let me go back in history. Back in 2002, which was a year after 9/11, September of 2002, we had 92% of Americans who said they were extremely or very proud to be an American, and that's the highest we've seen since we've been tracking this. Now, those numbers started to come down after that point and have been dropping since, but they dropped precipitously in the last year or two since Donald Trump took office, 75% last year and 72% this year. So let me be specific. 72% of Americans extremely or very proud to be an American, compared to 92% back in 2002. I mentioned Trump because the big reason that these proud numbers are lower is the drop in Democrats, who are significantly less likely to say they're proud to be an American at this point than Republicans.
Thanks, Frank.
You bet, Dave.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov, Brett Rader, and me. The news director is Eugene Son. Our assistant news director is Katie Colinari. John Massoni is assistant vice president for news operations. Our engineers this week were Bob Alls, Al Banks, and Diana Martinez. Sandra Clark is vice president of news and civic dialogue. Thanks for listening, and have a great weekend. I'm Kimberly Haas for NewsWorks Tonight.